welcome to the latest episode of the Dialogue Out Loud series. I'm Caroline Klein, co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Today, I'm joined by Suzanne E. Greco, author of the article Confronting Men's Violence Against Women and Girls in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which appears in the fall 2025 issue of Dialogue. Suzanne is a PhD candidate at the University of Edinburgh Divinity School. She holds degrees from BYU and Harvard Divinity School, and she has also worked with the United Nations and other international organizations on issues of gender-based violence. She writes both as a scholar and as a survivor, and her article calls on the church to confront what she calls a patriarchal vortex that leaves women and girls vulnerable to abuse. She outlines reforms in three areas: legal changes, empowering women's ministry, and training leaders and communities to respond better. We'll be talking to Suzanne about her personal journey, the church's current policies, and the reforms she believes could better align Latter-day Saint practice with its professed commitment to love, healing, and justice. Suzanne, welcome. I am so grateful that you are here today to share your work.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a privilege and honor to be here with you and address such an important topic.
It is so important, and it's unfortunately so timely. A lot of the time we hear these stories in the news about terrible abuse that happens. Let's start in the beginning, though. In your essay, you use the image of a patriarchal vortex to describe what happens to women in the church who experience abuse. Can you explain what that means to you and how you have seen it play out?
Yeah, so that's a really, really important question. And it's the only thing that I could describe what was happening to me and to other women. This patriarchal vortex is really how male-dominated power structures can create a kind of inescapable pull that silences and disempowers women. So in simple terms, you imagine a whirlpool. Once you're caught in its current, it's incredibly difficult to actually get out. So this vortex is made up of intertwined traditions, laws, social norms, often created and maintained by men, that normalize the dismissal of women's voices. So as feminist thinkers like just bell hook, for instance, as one have pointed out, this type of system can even distort our very understanding of love and power, which is really, really important. So in everyday church life, I see this vortex playing out in a few different ways. First, there's the buddy system of leadership. So when all the decision makers are men who work, serve, and socialize together, a natural male-to-male alliance forms. And this can unconsciously lead to believing a fellow male leader over the woman who comes forward with an accusation against a man. It's not necessarily malicious. It's a human bias amplified by a closed system. Mm-hmm. Another way is, it's called a redirect. A woman may gather the courage to go report the abuse. Only, she's taking her concerns to the bishop or the stake president, who is another man in the structure, right? And so this reinforces her isolation and once again, it doesn't protect her from the perpetration.
Yeah, and it also having like this leadership system with its only males that these women are supposed to go to about abuse, that also probably prevents the women from even going maybe in the first place, because they may not think that a man is going to take them seriously.
I was actually dragged in the first time to go report to a bishop, and I did not want to go in. And then other times, once I had overcome some of the hurdles, the fear was so great. I literally felt like angels were pushing me through the door to go talk because I didn't want to. Oh. So yeah, this is a huge hurdle for women. When your abuser was a man and you have to go talk to a man, you're just caught in this vortex, and it's terrible. It's really terrible. So it's cycles of silence and disempowerment. It's more than just good intentions by the church. It requires actively, you know, countering these male-to-male alliances. And the only way that we can do that, and this is based on the work that I studied under Diane Rosenfeld at Harvard Law. She's the gender violence director there. And she talks about female-to-female alliances. And we need to get women into this realm, or otherwise women will be continually caught in the vortex.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And you just touched very briefly on your own personal story. Unfortunately, you have some firsthand experience with the system, and you yourself were not believed when you went to your church leaders. Is there a reason? I mean, you just mentioned some of the reasons, like why the system of women going to male leaders is not going to be good in many ways. But do you think there's like a particular reason why it's hard for men to believe women when they say that they've been abused? Or is there something that a local ward can just do differently so that women, like, so that there's a culture of trusting women when they come forward and talk about abuse?
So, yeah, this is really complicated. Even women who hear women say, you know, I was sexually abused or whatever, they can have a hard time. So this this isn't just men, but it sits pretty heavily on men. I just want to, you know, bring that out there. But the harsh reality is women aren't believed without external proof. This is societal misogyny. In Kate Mann, I love Kate Mann. She talks about empathy. So sympathy is always skewed towards men. And this is seen in scientific studies. Like, we always want to side with the man for some reason. In the LDS context, this really ties into spiritual abuse, because it ties in directly to the patriarchal structures, which amplify doubt. The male leader is always right because he represents God, and God is always right and true. And we don't take into account the male fallibility part of that. So requiring women to gain validation from secular or outside institutions, or you need a prestigious someone, you know, other someone else to verify your testimony, actually has to happen. And in my case, it wasn't until I actually, you know, had some accreditation behind me, Harvard and the UN, that I was really actually taken seriously, or another victim coming forward, that all of a sudden, like, someone responded to my emails a little differently, like, oh, maybe we should take that seriously. So this is really, really difficult. And we shouldn't have to, women shouldn't have to borrow credibility from outside the faith, because our internal religious authority often, you know, they're going to prioritize the male perspective. It's just wrong. Women should be believed. The stats say that, you know, it's like 1 or 2% of women who will claim that there was an abuse case that's not true. So you should automatically believe a woman and a child if they come forward. You should, the stance should be belief. And that's in the secular world. If someone comes in and reports a case, the first responder will say, I believe you. But we don't do that in the church because they're not trained to do that.
Right. Right. And we're going to address that in just a minute. And actually, what you just said there about believing women, I remember a really influential talk by Chieko Okazaki, who I loved. She was a wonderful, as most of us know, leader in the General Relief Society presidency in the 1990s. And she talked about believing women, and she encouraged our leaders to believe women when women come to them about abuse. So, yeah, I think what you're raising is so important. And let's get into a little bit more of the details, because you have a vision of how this could work a lot better within the church. So let's say that someone in a ward does come forward to say, a bishop or a stake president, and that person says that they have been abused. Now, in your view, if we were to have a much better system in place, what would happen in those first 24 to 48 hours? Who should be involved? What should the role of the church be in this situation? And especially, you know, compared to the role of police or other authorities?
Yeah, so this gets really complicated and messy, but I'm going to do my best to give you what I think. First of all, it should be a woman that the reports are going to. The first responder should be a woman. There's other churches that are actually doing this, and this actually breaks through the patriarchal boundaries. So in the first 24 to 48 hours, this is a really, like you said, it's a critical window for any survivor to protect them and to cause, you know, more harm. So the absolute priority must be the safety and the autonomy of the survivor or the victim. They're the victim right now. But this means choice must guide every step. This is where the paradigm has to change in the church. So this is my view. I mean, there's protocols for secular views, but I'm trying to intertwine the LDS context. So the very first response from any leader or member should be, I believe you. Thank you for telling me. What do you need to feel safe right now? And this immediately places control back with the survivor. And from there, the church role, they need to provide resources and options, not to dictate an investigation or to call. And I'm going to talk about this, the church's helpline. Okay. So you have to present options and choices, even though they may have been traumatized. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. You need to let them have control. Otherwise, you are re-victimizing them again. Mm. So the stake president, I mean, right now, the protocol is any type of abuse situation is to go to the bishop or the stake president. And they are mandated to call the church's hotline. And this is a call to the church's attorney, and the church is their client. So they are not protecting the victim in any way. This will not help the victim. What needs to happen is rights need to be explained to the victim. And what this to me would look like, and I wish this had happened for me. What can I do to help you? Would you like me to help put you in touch with a professional advocate? Would you like to talk to the police? In some cases, the victim should actually call an attorney first. Mm-hmm. So this is where an outside NGO or specialist really can work with someone who's been traumatized and get them the professional advocacy that they need because they're so knowledgeable and they're connected. So this takes it out of the hands of the bishop, and then the victim actually gets the protection and help that whatever the case may be. And there's so many different, you know, things that can happen.
Yeah. And I love that part of your vision, placing agency and choice back in the hands of the victim, because I think maybe some of us might automatically think, well, if he hears about abuse, he should immediately tell the police or get her immediately to tell the police. But like you've mentioned, like that's not always going to be what the woman wants or maybe is even safe for the woman, right? And so asking those questions, like, what can I do to help you feel safe? Maybe even, do you want to leave? Can I help you leave and find a place to go? I mean, that things like that, I think where you're putting choice in her hands sounds right to me. That sounds really right to me.
Yeah, I just want to share this. So the church's role really should be to offer the survivors the support. And I don't think the church or the victim, because most of the time they've never been through this, they don't even know what they're getting into. I had no idea what I was stepping into. And it's so complicated. And, you know, asking for a place of safety, well, that might actually set off more victimization because the women, I mean, this gets into, you know, if the woman tells her husband, I'm going to leave, that is actually more dangerous. So if you have a professional support person, they can sit and talk through what's going on to make sure they're getting the right care, because this is so volatile sometimes. I don't think we understand. I don't think the church understands that, or they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be letting bishops do this in the first place. And in our stake, we lost a woman because she told her husband that she was leaving. I never told my husband I was leaving. I let him control that. So, because these type of people have to control it. So there's a lot of dynamics that are highly dangerous. And I think it's important that the church be networked into a professional advocate for this person.
Yeah. Oh, and I'm so glad you just said that, because I realized what I just suggested before, which is maybe the bishop should say, hey, do you want me to help you find a new place to go? I love that you said, actually, get her in touch, or allow her, you know, give her the resources to get in touch with a professional advocate that can walk through these options. Because like you said, sometimes taking off, or, you know, giving some kind of indication that the woman is leaving to the husband may lead to more violence, like terrible violence. So anyway, thank you. Thank you. You're right. This is so complex. Even someone like me, who is like a devoted feminist, like I don't have the training to know exactly what to do in a situation like this. And so, my goodness, how on earth can bishops and stake presidents do a good job? So this point about professional advocates and like having that resource right there, that phone number, that helpline right there for victims that come in, that sounds so important to me.
It's crucial. Yeah. I wish we had it. Yeah.
And I'm going to go back to another thing that you mentioned, which I love this point. One of your main arguments in the article is that we need to empower women to be the people that receive the reports of abuse, like within the system, within the structure. There needs to be women's ministry where women know that they can go to women, that they should go to women when there are situations of abuse going on. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that might look like. Like, let's think in an LDS context, like what would that look like in practice, and how do you see that kind of changing the experience for the survivor?
Yeah, this is really, really important. This is the crux of it, right? So proposing women report to women, you know, it's not that we're trying to exclude the men. It's about creating safer, more accessible entry points for support, right? So immediately you can build trust. It creates the counter alliances that I've talked about a little bit. And it can help streamline the help that these women are going to get. So, you know, in the ward, this could be, you know, there's a couple possibilities, and I've seen different models in different churches. It could be the Relief Society president. I mean, she's got a lot on her plate, or it could be a specific calling as the woman's advocate in the ward as a trained first responder in this role. So there's different ways that this could be handled. And this woman would help this, whatever situation, and they would have authority. And this is key. They would have authority to immediately connect her to professional services, like we said, whether it's law enforcement, counselors, whatever, without the bishop's authority or approval. Okay, they can get her the help she needs instantly without going through, oh, we have to report this to the church first and the hotline. That's got to go away. Yeah. And this person can offer them emotional support, and, you know, if the victim wants spiritual support, she could get that through the bishop if she wants that type of ministerial support, or she could get it through the Relief Society president, or, you know, a ministering sister if that was the right fit. But they need that hand-to-hand support sometimes. And, That's really hard because most people in the ward have no clue. So this person needs to be trained. And the people that are brought into the system, it's only at the consent of the victim. Anyone brought into this sphere, it's by the consent of the victim. That's really, really important because a lot of women, the shame, women are always shamed throughout this whole process. And I have a lot of respect. David Holland, who worked with me for a decade, he really did his best to minimize the shame. So I would go see him every couple of months, and he didn't make it so I had, oh, she's going in again to see the state president. She's going into me. Well, there's something wrong with her. You know, she's going to, all the shame that goes on with these cases, never mind your family and the disarray, but we can do a lot to minimize the shame that's going to be lumped and heaped on the women, because the women always carry the shame of the family breakdown in our LDS culture.
Mm. Yeah, no, I'm so glad you just described that. So such an important thing. And I honestly, when you were talking about women, like women going to women and women being empowered within the system as advocates who had like the knowledge of where the hotlines, the places she can go, all this kind of stuff, that actually gave me chills, because this is so doable. This is not hard. This is not hard at all. It's just like you said, I kind of like the idea of it being a new calling, a calling to be, I don't know what we would call it, the women's advocate. I'm not sure what we would call it, but it's so doable. You know, this one person gets trained on the resources.
This is the model they're using in other churches. And there are some caveats to it. And I will mention this, okay? I think this is really important to understand. So with this shift, some women, when they get power, and sometimes women from privileged backgrounds, we tend to be narcissistic in our church because the family, together forever family, whatever, and abuse, when that is lumped on your family, this causes a lot of problems. So privileged women in leadership positions, they carry biases, stigmas, you know, a lot of stigmas, and they have to be trained to overcome these to be effective. And that requires some training, obviously, right? And additionally, a lot of women, they buy into the patriarchal bargain, vying for influence within the existing structures. And I've heard other women talk about this in other models in other churches, that they just bow to the priesthood leader, they report everything to him instead of just doing what the work they need to help the survivor. So we have to be aware of that there are caveats, and whoever is serving in this position has to do it in a faithful way, that their first priority is to help the victim, not to go spread gossip or go talk to the, you know, maybe the bishop will be brought in, but that's at the consent of the victim. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just want, there's some dynamics that we need to be aware of if we flip the narrative to giving women power.
Yeah. And that's so important. You're right. Not all women are going to automatically be awesome at this kind of stuff. They need training too. A lot of training to be as effective as they can be. So yeah. I appreciate that. You talk also in your article about a concept called DARVO. And this is where abusers like deny, attack, and flip the story. And you also talk about teaching consent, even inside marriage. So how can members and leaders learn to spot these patterns and talk about consent more openly? What is your vision for how to educate like this?
Yeah, we need sexual education in our church. We really do. And not just for the youth, but we need it all around. So DARVO, I think this was the hardest thing for my leaders. And then I was introduced to This and a bunch of scholars' work as I was reading it. And actually, my brother sent me an article when I was going through this, and I was like, oh my gosh. So Darvo, deny, attack, and reverse victim offender is a highly manipulative tactic where abusers, they deny the wrongdoing, they assail the accuser's credibility, and reposition themselves as the victim. And we see this all the time out in the world, but we don't think that good LDS people would actually do this, but it happens every day, okay? In order to spot those patterns, we really need to have education on two levels, both on a leadership level and at the community levels, whether they do on a fifth Sunday or whatever. It needs to be on both levels. You can't just do this on a leadership level and not have everybody involved. So it needs to happen on both sides, and it needs to happen yearly. And this can be done by bringing in trained professionals, because people don't understand this concept, yet it's used so effectively by men all the time. And regarding consent, I could talk for hours on this. Bishops blame women for like what they wore or whatever. Like, no, it's not about that. Like let me go through consent just really quickly, because I don't want to make it too long. It could be lengthy. But consent is a choice made without pressure or manipulation or threats. It's informed. Both partners know what they're going to do or what they want to do. So if they agree to use protection and they don't, that's not consent. That's a violation. It's the act of sex is voluntary. There is absolutely no coercion involved, and it's always active. Consent is always active and ongoing, and silence is not consent. Okay. Silence is not consent. It requires, yeah, okay, or in whatever way that looks like. And it has to be continuous throughout the whole encounter. If something doesn't feel right, and the woman, even if you're married, and she says, stop that it doesn't feel good, the partner needs to stop. They need to stop, because consent is taken away. It's off the plate. So consent is revocable at any time throughout the encounter of intimacy. And that we don't understand. I think a lot of, forgive me, this is a broad brush, I'm going to say this. A lot of men in the LDS church feel like they have sexual rights and ownership of the woman that they're married to. And that is a cultural, whatever faux pas that needs to just go away. It needs to go away. You do not have sexual rights to the woman that you're married to or your partner that you're married to. It's not right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that is such an important message that I don't think I've ever heard that message within our church structure, like on in the 3-hour block or 2-hour block. I've never heard marital consent talked, or even any kind of consent, now that I think about it, talked about. Though I have not been in the young women's program for a long time, but still such an important thing. And I like the idea that this could be a fifth Sunday yearly education type of thing about these patterns of abuse and how to stop these patterns of abuse. I think that just sounds so important.
Yeah.
Another thing you bring up in your article that I really appreciated is the fact that the church doesn't collect or seem to be collecting and definitely not sharing data on abuse. And I was wondering if the church did decide to do this, collect and share data on abuse, what kinds of things would you like to see tracked and reported? And how could this tracking and reporting make women and girls safer?
Yeah, this is at the heart of it. This is a great question. So I really want to see this happen. If the church were to implement, a robust, transparent reporting system, there are several key kind of metrics that would be crucial to track. And this would need to be, you know, anonymized to protect survivors. Privacy is really, really critical and important here. So the nature and scope of reports, we need data categorized by types of abuse, distinguishing, for example, between child sexual abuse, intimate partner violence, spiritual coercion. Those are a few categories. We need to figure out the institutional response, including, you know, tracking responses from initial reports, what happens to the conclusion of the, you know, of what happens to the survivor or victim. So most importantly, we need clarity on outcomes. How many reports were referred to law enforcement or to, you know, a professional, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And also, and this is something that is that I know the church would push back on, but, you know, we have this inside closed ecclesiastical court system. What are the results of those disciplinary councils? Because having talked to some key high up attorneys in this area, this is where things go really, really wrong, really, really wrong. So there needs to be a lot of work there. And also, this is really important. And this is where you're going to get the data that tells all. That's surveying the survivors once they've been through the process. Mm. Were they believed? Were they supported? What type of support did they receive? Did they feel safe? So that actually centers the voice of the victim and the survivor. And that's what's happening on all these other platforms. It's the survivor is the most important. And I just want to share this. So the power of the data, it's not just in counting incidents. It's in comparative analysis. So, you know, you talk about academic work and survivors' testimonies, and there's certain cultural dynamics in the LDS church that I see, and some other scholars see engendering and enabling abuse. Okay. So with reliable data, we could then compare that to national standards. Are we actually experiencing higher levels of abuse? What type of cultural things are invoking that? This is really important to create change and health for the women. If the women are half the, you know, make up half the church and they're the ones primarily responsible for raising the children and they're getting violated all the time and they don't get the support, that becomes intergenerational abuse. And we see that, and that's been tracked. So that's really, really important data to, you know, overcome some of these internal, I don't know what you want to call them. There's nothing has come forward. And this is where we've got to break ground. We've got to, and the church needs to start looking at this seriously, because if they keep harming the women and children, they're going to leave the church. Women and children are leaving the church because of some of these issues, and it's going to continue. And then who's going to be left in the church? A whole bunch of men. Great. They can have a party with themselves. You know, like, I don't know. It's yeah.
Yeah. No. And I really appreciated what you just said there about how women need to be surveyed after they go through this process about, you know, were they believed, you know, and, you know, what could we do better? Like, I think if that kind of survey existed, the church could do so much good in terms of improving, its ability to help women who are facing this terrible situation. And so, and again, that sounds like a really very possible thing. You just kind of create a survey that you give to women after they've gone through the process. I mean, this doesn't sound that hard. So,
sorry, one thing I do want to add, I mean, my article focuses on women and, you know, women and children, but I do want to recognize this. Men are abused all the time also. And, you know, that dynamic, I don't weave into this article, but they are part of this too. So I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, no, that is such a great thing to also think about. And maybe that's like maybe some future work for you might be possibly to think about how this can work out for men who and boys. Oh, well, we're talking about children and women here, but yeah, for men who are being abused. So that's a great thing to bring up as well. Well, I don't want to take too much of your time. So let's wind down this interview a little bit. And I want to ask you, because you have such personal experience with this topic and your story is so heartbreaking, but also hopeful. And I was wondering if you could talk to us about what kept you going when you felt like you were being silenced or not believed by your leaders.
Yeah, so my path was really, really tough. I mean, it took over 15 years, really long and really, really traumatizing. And I just published my book called The Stone Sphere. It's memoir, it's investigative journalism, I give an academic treatment to it. It's will help survivors in the LDS church. And I can honestly say this, the only true thing that kept me going, because I was suicidal at a lot of moments throughout this. I mean, the pain and the trauma was really, really severe. And that was God and angels, ministering angels. I had profound, vivid dreams that showed me bits of my future. They gave me hope to hold on when I absolutely did not want to be here anymore. The pain and just, I mean, there was, I will share this, like David Holland, I landed into David Holland. He was our newly ordained stake president. I didn't know the man. And he really offered me a lot of ecclesiastical support in ministering, but he also caused a lot of harm, because he was untrained and he didn't know that. And he let me use his name in my book. And he allowed me to share the good and the bad. And this is really, really important. It's really, really important. So a lot of change needs to happen in our church. So we don't, you know, when I come forward to talk about things and to get help, and I'm trusting in these, you know, authorities, because I put all of my trust in God and they are God's servants. This is where we've got to, you know, we've got to create the change. We've got to create the change. Yeah. Because if I hadn't had God and angels, I wouldn't be talking to you today. We wouldn't be doing this today, mm-hmm. which is really sad. It's really sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. No, I love that you had that personal connection with deity that allowed you to have the resilience, that helped you to have the resilience to get through a horrendously difficult process and situation. So thank you for your vulnerability in talking about that. And just as a last question, is there anything you'd like to end this interview with? Maybe perhaps what you hope your readers and listeners here will take away from this article, from this project?
Yeah, this article is huge. I wrote a pilot project with Diane Rosenfeld and David Holland. I mean, she's the violence gender director at Harvard Law. And I tried to get it through the church in several ways and several means. And then it got shut down over and over again, which was really disappointing. And then with the help of Taylor Petrie, it evolved into this article. And so I want to thank him for his support in this and for also the scholars that helped form it, because it, you know, it got peer reviewed and that was really, really important. And I really, the impetus in all of my work and why I'm doing this work is things have to change. Things have to change in the LDS church. We have got to stop hurting women and children and protecting and upholding perpetrators. Things have got to change. And I'm a spiritual person, and I believe God is not happy with what is happening right now. I know he did not want me to go through all of this. Like, and women have experienced this for centuries. So I really, really do hope this article will bring forth dialogue, not only with scholars and academics across the realm, but can be brought to the church leaders, and that they'll read this. They don't have to go read my 280-page book, although it's a quick read, but they can read this article and they're going to get the gist of who Susie Greco is, and, you know, all the miracles that have put me, you know, from wanting to commit suicide and being abused to the UN. Like, how did that happen? How did that happen? Like, these are miracles. These are miracles. And I hope that people can see that. And I do believe God wants me to be a voice for LDS women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you so much. I think that's a wonderful note to end on. I'm so glad you were able to join us today. And I just want to thank you for your courage in sharing both your research and your lived experience. And to our listeners, we hope that you have found this conversation meaningful. You can read Suzanne's full article called Confronting Men's Violence Against Women and Girls in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the fall 2025 issue of Dialogue. If you enjoyed this episode, please do share it with friends or colleagues, and don't forget to leave us a review or reach out with your comments and questions. Be sure to subscribe to this show and check out the other great podcasts in the Dialogue Podcast Network. This has been Caroline Klein. Thank you for joining us, and until next time.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.